Something in halacha a little bit, and then something in Jewish. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah. Each week will be a different thing, because I don't know if we can make it every week and so on. So Parshas Toldos, at the very end of the first Aliyah by Sheni, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Yitzhak he's going to give him all kinds of things, including Eretz Yisrael. In the Zechus Avram, it says, Ekev Asher Shoma Avram Bekoli, Vayishmor Mishmarti, Mitzochsai, Chukosai, and the next word? Huh? Very good, Vesorosai. So first of all, I kept all my mitzvahs, all my chukim, and all my toros. So something, what do you mean toros in the plural? How many toros are there? Right. So what's the answer? How many Torahs are there?
Seven.
Well, we just assume one. According to five books of the Chumash, according to one opinion, the Gemara with the backwards nun says seven. But Torah Sam means two Torahs. Actually, we do have two Torahs. Oh, very good. One is called Torah Shav Sab, one is called Torah Shav Peh. Now, usually we assume incorrectly, many people think Torah Shav Peh means the laws of the Rabbanon. That's not true. Torah Shav Peh is also derisive. For example, the fact that tefillin has to be black never says that in the written Torah anyplace. In fact, never says the word tefillin anywhere in the written Torah. You know that? The whole written Torah never says. What does it say? Uksharatam, lo sayadecha, vilototova. How in the world do we know what that means? Even in English we don't know what it means. Phylacteries. When we ask the guy on the street, what are phylacteries? He doesn't know. The only people who know what phylacteries are, oh, tefillin. Right? So not, even in English we don't know what it means, right? So how do we know that tefillin are... What's the answer we know from the Shema Peh? But it's not a rabbinic law. Everyone agrees tefillin's a mitzvah deraisa for sure. Right? The Torah gives us the word. It was left up to the Rabbanan to explain, not to interpret. It wasn't a rabbinic law. A rabbinic law is that you're not allowed to... You're learning chulin, right? You're all learning... What parak you're learning? You're learning first parak. Okay, later on you'll learn... probably second half of the year, about Bosu. You know, the chicken is not really considered meat on a Torah level, just on a rabbinic level. Strictly speaking, according to the Torah, you're allowed to eat chicken with milk. You just can't have what we call red meat, beef with milk. But the Rabbanan made it xera. You shouldn't eat chicken with milk either because, you know, people mix up. People call chicken meat also, right? Turkey, as far as the next Thanksgiving, we call it meat also, right? White meat, dark meat, right? We call it meat. Okay, the Hebrew also mix it up, but that's the law from the Rabbanan. Now, that's not the same thing as the tefillin have to be black, or that the parshas and the tefillin are the four parshas we put in tefillin. That's not a law of the Rabbanan, it's a law of the Raisa. Just not written explicitly in the Torah. There are many things, we think about it, many things. The word shofar, how do you know instrument? What does it say about Rosh Hashanah? It's Yom, what does it say in the Torah? Yom? Yom Trua Yelachem. What does Yom Trua mean? The day of making some kind of a tooting sound. So I could do it with a bugle also. I could do it with a French horn. Who says it got to be a shofar? So it never says the word shofar. It says it's not true the word shofar doesn't appear in the Torah, but it doesn't appear in the Torah connected to Rosh Hashanah. So how do we know every kindergartner knows that every nursery school student knows that the instrument you blow in the Rosh Hashanah is a shofar? How did it have the kid, you have a little brother, a little sister in kindergarten? You knew when you were in kindergarten. What do you blow in shofar? You have songs about a shofar. Who told you that it was a shofar? Who told you? Who told you that it was a shofar? Your teacher, your father, your mother, right? Who told them?
Their teacher.
Who told them?
Their teacher.
It goes all the way back. That's Torah Shav Peh. It's not a din d'rabbanan. That's not a rabbinic law that you have to blow shofar. Of course, it's a Torah law you have to blow shofar. You follow what I'm saying? So when we say that Torah Shav Tzav and Torah Shav Peh, Torah Shav Peh is the, we'll talk about it more maybe a different time, but Torah Shav Peh is the interpretation or the explanation of what it means in the Torah Shav Tzav. That's also from the Torah. So there are two Torahs, Torah Shav Tzav and Torah Shav Peh. But it's interesting, Torah Shav Peh can also, does also include the rabbinic laws, the rabbinic restrictions. So it's interesting, based on that pasuk in this week's sedur, the very last mission, Maseches Kiddushin, Daf Pei Beis, tells us that Avraham Avinu observed all the laws of the Torah even before they were given. You ever hear that mission? He gives all the laws of them before they get the mission. It's not a Hasidic Vart or something. It's a Mishnah. Mishnah Kiddushin. Avraham Avinu kept all the laws. How do we know? This pasuk. It says, Eikev Asher Shoma Avraham Bekoli Vayishmor Mishmarti Mitzosai Chukosai. So he kept all the laws. Then there's a Gemara in Yuma that doesn't refer to the Mishnah. It says a similar thing. The what? Afilo Erev Tavshilin. Kept even Erev Tavshilin. You know what, remember what Erev Tavshilin is? Erev Tavshilin is when you have Chag, right, exactly. When Chag, when Yontev comes right before Shabbos. You know, let's say Yontev is on Friday. It's coming Pesach, will be like that. It's coming Pesach, like Yontev on Thursday and Friday, the first 2 days of Pesach. So the rule, we know you're allowed to cook on Yontev, but you're only allowed to cook on Yontev for Yontev. I can't cook on Yontev. Let's say I'm having a dinner party next week. I have a lot of company. So I figure, you know what? I have free time on Yontif. Let me cook today. I'll get some, put it in the freezer. You know how to do that? I'll let it cook on Yontif for Yontif itself. So sometimes Friday is Yontif, or Thursday and Friday Yontif, outside of Eretz Yisrael. How do you cook for Shabbos? So the Rabbanan said that what you're allowed to do is you begin the cooking process already on Wednesday. How do you begin the process? You set aside, you cook something, a piece of cooked food, or you take a cooked hard-boiled egg, a piece of fish, something that's cooked, and a baked item, a piece of matzah, a piece of challah, something like that, and you set that aside for Shabbos, so then you're allowed to cook on Friday because you already started the process. Anyway, that's a detail. It's called Erev Tavshilin. It comes up every couple of years, Yontif time. This year will be like that, both Pesach and Shavuos, because Shavuos also, Shavuos on Friday and Shabbos this year. So it says that Avraham Aminu kept those, that's a din d'Rabbanan. So the Gemara implies that Avraham kept not only the Raisas, but he kept all the Rabbanans too. We have a different, what does that mean? He kept what he had, a Pesach Seder? He waved a lulav? It's hard to understand what exactly it means. So that requires further thought. And he kept Erev Tavshil. So what, he observed Yontif? He observed Pesach before Pesach happened? No, we have to, that's a big subject. You have to understand what that means, what Chazal meant, that Avraham kept all the mitzvahs. A complicated subject a little bit. But even assuming that he did, so some raise a question. Didn't we read a couple of weeks ago that when the Malachim came, what did Avraham serve them? Lot served them matzah. What did Avraham serve them? Basar v'chalav. Remember it said he took the ben abakar, the meat, and also it says vayikach chema v'chalav, butter, cream, milk. What's going on? So Chazal said, well, okay, it's before Matan Torah. Yeah, but we said Avraham kept them into before Matan Torah. So some say...
Maybe he knew they weren't
Jewish and not obligated. Yeah, maybe the question wasn't true. They were at first. But the Mishnah says in Chulin that Midr Rabbanan, you're not only not allowed to eat meat and milk together, you can't even put it at the table at the same time. You can't have the same time. I'm sitting down having a fleishig supper. There shouldn't be anything on the table. Milchiks. Why? Mishnah Chulin. Why? What's the obvious reason why? You make a mistake, right? Just the nashing, right? There's this food on the table. There's a piece of cheese on the table. You forget. You'll get it. So the Mishnah says in Chulin, don't put milk and fleishing. Don't put milk and fleishing on the same table at the same time. What if I have the following? Maybe this happens in your house sometimes, especially on a Thursday night. What if I have one person eating fleishing, and one person says, Thursday night, my mother says to me, we have leftovers tonight. Because it's not cooking for Shabbat. Leftovers. So there's a piece of steak left from early in the sub. There's also some macaroni and cheese left. So I decide I'm going to have a piece of steak, and my brother's going to have macaroni and cheese. Can we eat at the same table? So the Mishnah says yes. The Mishnah says yes. You're allowed to, as long as there was something with a heker in between. Like you use a different tablecloth. You put something in the way just as a reminder. We're dealing with religious people. We're not going to do it on purpose. Just afraid you might forget. So you have a reminder. So there is a discussion in the Shulchan Aruch. What if I don't have a reminder, but there's somebody else there at the table who's not eating, who's going to remind me? When I'm sitting by myself, so I may forget, but let's say there's somebody there who's going to remind me, right? Oh, don't do that. Don't forget your fleshing. Is that good enough? Or do you need a physical hekka? So it's actually a machlokas, kiveig and a pisca chuba in Yoridaeus and in Sadi's Pesach, which is similar about the beginning of Bas V'Cholav, as to whether a shomer, someone watching me, does that count or not? So some want to suggest that you look at that pasuk in Parshas Vayir a couple of weeks ago. It says Avraham served them, and then it said V'hu omeid aleihem tachas v'eitz v'yochela. He stood by. Oh, he was a shomer. He made sure some of the malachim ate milk, some of the fleishing, and served them whatever like. But he stood to watch. So I want to prove from there. Oh, you see that the shomer worked. And it's a machlokas where the shomer works. Okay. In any event, Avraham Avinu kept all the laws based on this pasuk of Sarosa. That's a dvar halacha. Okay. Now, in terms of drush. So it's interesting, Yitzchak Avinu, of all the others, gets the least press coverage. Right? There's very little about Yitzchak in the whole Torah. Last week was about Yitzchak, but he was a passive player. It was about finding a wife for Yitzchak, but that was mostly done by the servant, Eliezer, right? Avraham orchestrated Eliezer. At the very end, Yitzchak meets the one and he marries her, Shkoyach. But there's very little information about Yitzchak. And 2 weeks ago, the Akedah, he's involved, but he's also a passive participant, right? This week is really the only sedra where Yitzchak is the active player, because next week already is Vayetze Yaakov, where it shows all episode, the whole story of Yaakov running to the house of Lavan and so on and so forth. So Yaakov takes over. So this told is only the only sedra. Even here, you know, Yitzchak wants to give the bracha to Esav, and he's mixed up and doesn't see well, so Yaakov's able to trick him. Yitzchak gets very little attention. it's something to ponder in general. Why Yitzchak of all the others? And actually, he lived the longest. He had the longest lifespan. Not by that much. He lived to 180. Avraham, we read last week, to live to 175. Yaakov, we read later in the Chumash, died at 147. So Yitzchak lived the longest, but we have the least information about him. What information do we have? The information we do have in this week's Sedra doesn't seem to be all that important. It says he lived by the Plishtim, and he dug wells. Okay, in the Sedra, he dug wells. But it wasn't that he dug wells, he redug the wells that Avraham had dug, and the Plishtim stuffed them up. Okay, and he called them by the same old names that his father had called them. Why is that so significant? Well, in the olden days, wells were very significant, because that was your water supply. Here we go to the sink, and turn on water, we have running water. In the olden days, water came from wells. In fact, you'll think about it for a second. You see other places in the Chumash where the well was like a gathering place of people. So we had last week, right? Eliezer came, so the women were coming to draw. People hung around the well. It was like everyone needs water. Everyone needs water for drinking and for bathing and washing and so on. So the well was like a hangout, so people went. Right, Moshe Rabbeinu is by the well also. He meets the daughters of Yisro, right? And Yaakov meets... The well was a center. Okay, so Yitzchak dug wells. It's an important thing. But what the Torah is stressing, that he dug the wells, not new wells, but old wells that his father Avraham had dug, and the Plishtim stuffed them up. That's so important. Okay, didn't dug wells. That's all we know about Yitzchak, pretty much. So there's a lot of the Ramban says it speaks about three wells, and they were referred to the three Batei Mikdash. But maybe the significance of Yitzchak is the following. When Avraham Avinu died, okay, Avraham Avinu had a unique worldview at that time, right? Right? He was the first person, really, to believe in monotheism, one God. Everyone else was idol worshippers, the pagans. And, you know, what do people think about Avraham? The guy maybe is a crackpot. You know, he's got a funny view of everything. He's a nice guy. Lots of guests at his house. You know, all right, he's got these weird ideas. Strange ideas. In fact, some say that's why he was called Avraham HaIvri. You know, you ever heard the expression Avraham HaIvri? What does Ivri mean?
You know? Hebrew.
So there was what? Right. So one definition of Hebrew means Ivri because he came from the other side of the river. He came from across the river. Across, right? Others Avraham HaIvri is because he was a descendant of Aver, Shem and Aver, Ivri. But what you guys are saying, that's the third, all three interpretations appear in the Medrash, because he was on the other side of the world from everybody else. Everyone else believed like this, he believed like that. So many people felt, okay, you know, well, he's a nice guy, but as soon as he dies, all his wacky ideas are going to die with him. They go to the grave with him. We don't have to worry about him anymore. And so that's what's symbolic of the Plishtim, that when Avraham died, they stuffed up the wells. What does it mean? They tried to silence all his ideas, not just the physical wells. What Avraham represented, we're done with that nut and his funny ideas, okay, about one God and all this. Now comes along Yitzchak. What does Yitzchak say? Oh no, we're continuing it. So he redug the very same wells that my father's recipe didn't go to the grave with him. I believe in it too. We're going to continue this way of life. We're going to continue belief in one God and so on. So therefore he opened up all the wells and he called them by the exact same name that his father had called them, to say, I'm continuing the tradition of my father. He's not dead, he's physically dead, but his ideas are still here. That's the godless of Yitzchak. The God of Yitzchak was to continue. You know, sometimes it's harder even to continue something than to start something new. Some people have that skill, you know, they're innovative, they always start something new. They get a lot of credit. They deserve it in any area, in business, in anything, right? Start coming up with something new ideas. If people like it, they go along with it and so on. The second guy comes along, he's not going to get that much credit because it wasn't his idea. But he believes in it, so he continues it. Right? I'm not doing anything new. Okay? I'm not an innovator necessarily. But I believe in what was done before me, and I'm going to work hard to continue it. That's the greatness of Yitzchak. And in a certain sense, Yitzchak is the first person to represent what we call Masorah. What's Masorah? Transmitting to the next generation. Yitzchak continued it. Yitzchak continued what Avraham had started. You follow? That's the godless of Yitzchak. And maybe he didn't innovate himself. We know he did innovate some things. Chazal tell us in the last week, he said he innovated davening mincha, praying in the afternoon. other things. Maisa and Isvik said they tied, you know, they took. I'm saying he didn't innovate anything. But in terms of the idea of monotheism, he wasn't the innovator, he was the continuer. And sometimes, it's well, the reason that's so important is because many people sometimes take the attitude, this guy's got his weird ideas, okay, when he's not in the picture anymore, we won't have to think about it anymore. Comes along somebody else, no, I'm continuing ideas. So perhaps we can suggest that the godless of Yitzhak Avinu was, as I said, the first idea of Mesorah, of taking something that he represents, transmitted to the next generation, which is so important to us down to this day. That's the godless of Yitzhak. Okay?
Rebbe, just one question. In history, we're learning about that 15,000 years from science, we learned that like, the star is 14 billion light years away. The universe,
how do we justify that? It's
14 billion years old. How do we justify that?
Right, so that's a big issue. It's a major problem. There are answers to it. There's some who suggest, I'm not personally bothered with the suggestion, but there's some who suggest the following, that when the world was created, how do we rectify the fact the world is 5,780 years old? So, one approach is, there are certain Gedolei Torah say that, I'm not convinced that it's the best approach, but I will share it with you anyway. The Babich Rebbe, Zichron Baruch Hu, said this, others have said this, that when the world was created, it was created with things already in place that made it look much older, meaning the following. Let's say you have a tree, right? So you can measure the age of the tree based on the rings. You know about that, right? When Gan Eden was created on the third day of creation, the trees were already fully, many trees were already, we assume, already fully developed. So if I would chop down that tree on the first day of creation, I would tell, oh, this tree must be 100 years old. Really, it's only 2 minutes old, right? You follow, Adam and Chava didn't come in as babies. They came in as adults. Right, I think according to Chazal, one place the appearance of a 20-year-old. They weren't 20 years old; they're 2 minutes old. You follow? So just because somebody, because Rome created the world, so certain planets already from the time of their existence. You understand that approach? That's one approach. Another approach, again, this is a big, big subject, and perhaps we can go into detail a different time. But another approach is that the world that we live in is not the first. Chazal tells us it's not the first world that Akkadosh Baruch Hu created. Because Baruch created and destroyed many worlds before this one. Why and what? I mean, that's a magic. Have you heard that? Because Baruch created and destroyed many worlds before this one. So it could well be that when he destroyed those worlds, certain things he left, he didn't destroy everything. So indeed, many things are much older. The world as we know it is 5,780 years old, but there may be certain components which were created before. As a matter of fact, it says about the Torah, okay, Pasuk Tillim, Dovar Ksiva Le'elef Dor. You have an expression? It's a pasuk until the same Shabbos. Shabbos specifically. Dovar Ksiva Le'elef Dor. Which on Stumra Chazal, the Torah was given in the 1,000th generation. What do you mean? To go from Adam to Moshe Rabbeinu, 26 generations. Not 1,000 generations. No, but there were, quote-unquote, things before. Okay, so if you're interested in this subject, Rabbi Arya Kaplan, you may have heard of the Chumash, the Living Torah. You ever see that Chumash? That's his translation. So he wrote a long essay about this, the age called The Age of the Universe. I have the book at home. I'm willing to lend it, or maybe have the library. You can get it at the library. It's called Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe. There's a Drush Orach Chaim, one of the important commentaries, and he figures out that actually science can very well fit in, because you figure out what is 26 generations and so on. I'm sorry, 974 generations. That's 1,000 generations. And only we're 26, and it's 974. 974, you do the math, it comes out very often similar to what science. Not, okay? And there are others who have dealt with this concept as well. So those are two answers that I prefer this personally. The second answer, that there are things in the world which were created long before. Then you have the further question, the Sheshnei Bereishis, were they 24-hour days? Were they longer? So there are a number of different approaches. Yeah.
On a similar note, like, how do we rectify, like, how do we combine evolution with how we believe?
So that's also an issue. Okay, again, these are very broad subjects. There are books written by observant Jewish scientists. Two in particular, Genesis and the Big Bang, Professor Schroeder and Nathan Abiezer, in the beginning, I think it's called. You can get these books. They're available. You should read them into the subject. Again, evolution. There is, in a certain sense, evolution in the sense that there are similarities, in traits, and certain animals are created first. Not that we come from those animals, okay, but they were created before us, that there are you know, basic similarities, you know, between the apes and human beings and so on. And those are higher. You look through again in the Shasim Abrashis, you find that you know the creatures were created in, shall we say, ascending order in terms of the, you know, the fifth day and eventually the big and then the sixth day animal. So it was a progression, so to speak, not evolution in the sense that, you know, this Adam Rishon came from monkey, okay, but in the sense of progression of species, that's not necessarily antithetical to the Torah. No. So antithetical, it's not against the Torah, there's a progression and so on. Not that we descended from those creatures, but you follow. So anyway, these are very, very broad subjects, more than we have time for these morning. But if you're interested particularly, there are books available, you know, that's justifiable. You know, we don't have to assume that, we don't have to assume, as scientists do, the Torah is wrong. We don't have to assume that some people do that, the science. Some, again, in some circles, they'll tell you, well, the science is wrong, and that's it. I don't agree with that person either. I'm not saying, you know, big coming up a chacham would say, well, the science, what do they know? I don't think that's correct. I think we do recognize what science knows. We have to figure out. We don't understand everything. But there are books written about it. Okay. Very good.
It doesn't work out.
Is it no good?
No, just if it won't happen, like we don't have to.
Oh, that's an email, man.